Good day to everyone. My talk today will be devoted to Kurt Gödel's so-called second theorem, the theorem about the incompleteness of arithmetic. He produced that in 1931. Why second theorem? Because in 1929, as part of his thesis, he had produced the first theorem about completeness, where he demonstrated the completeness of logic of the first order. His second theorem is famous, and it's so famous that that's the reason why it caught my attention. It caught my attention through a book published in 1997 by Sokal and Bricmont, and called in French called Imposture Intellectuelle. It was that book was about what the authors regarded as the dare of social scientists, philosophers, to sometimes refer to mathematics, and suggesting that they'd better not do that because most of the time they didn't understand at all the mathematics that was involved, and they were just making idiots of themselves by doing so. In particular, were attacked Jacques Lacan, the psychoanalyst, who I was lucky enough to know, to be acquainted with. I did my didactic analysis with a I trained as a psychoanalyst with one of his pupils, Philippe Julien, in Paris, back in the days. The book Imposture Intellectuelle was attacking, therefore, social scientists in a violent manner. They were attacking also Régis Debray. Régis Debray had said something which is very important, and which those days I'm repeating about the situation in France. We think that we can talk about politics, taking just into account political issues, but he said there's always in the background an element which comes from elsewhere, and which is most of the time decisive in truth, which is religion. And Lacan was supposed to be ridiculous because he referred to mathematics, and but I know that in mathematics he was always asking for the advice of Georges Théodule Guilbault, a famous French mathematician. I was the pupil of Guilbault back in the late 60s at the École Pratique des Hautes Études, where Guilbault was teaching mathematics for social scientists. And so when Lacan was using mathematics, he always did it very carefully, asking advice to a proper mathematician. Guilbault was also an advisor of Claude Lévi-Strauss. Lévi-Strauss, he repeated that to me in a conversation, that he was not a mathematician, didn't understand anything in mathematics, which was totally untrue. I've never met a mathematical mind so good as that of Lévi-Strauss. I could give examples of that from lectures, but this is not what we're talking about today. We're talking about Kurt Gödel's theorem. I called Gödel's ledger domain, and the subtitle is the demonstration of his incompleteness of arithmetic theorem betrays his contempt for his fellow mathematicians, because I think that was the most striking when you read this the demonstration of his is that he regards you, the reader, as an idiot who will never understand, will never be able to fly as high as he does. And that doesn't apply only to people like me who've been essentially applied mathematicians, but it applied also to his colleagues. You may know that when his theorem was published in 1931, there was a huge debate. Some people saying it was remarkable, and some other people saying it was junk. And among the people who said it was junk was Guilbault, and he in a little book published in 1940s with Daval on the mathematical method, he makes a few criticism of Gödel's theorem, which I will mention later on. Another of the critics of Gödel right away was Chaim Perelman. Chaim Perelman, I was his pupil in that university in Brussels. A great philosopher, a great logician, who put a lot of attention on rhetorics, really a major figure, and who criticized also Gödel in his demonstration. Ladrière, who in the 50s wrote a book about the reception of Gödel's theorem, underlines the following, that a lot of people said it was remarkable, his demonstration, another lot of people said it was really bad, and Ladrière goes into the argument of everybody around there and shows that among the people who critiqued Gödel, a number of people made errors. But he underlines also that among the people who were enthusiasts, a lot of those people who were enthusiasts showed in their defense, they had no notion what was really going about. Why is that because of the complication of the demonstration. Because I knew, when I read the book by Sokal and Brickmore, because I knew from my own practice, that so-called hard scientists and mathematicians are some kind of hard scientists, are also really careless in what they do. I wanted to know a bit more about the demonstration, which was supposed to be such a sacred cow that these stupid social scientists and philosophers should never even mention that. So I got curious and I said, okay, well, let's have a look at that demonstration by Gödel of his theorem about the incompleteness of arithmetic. And what did I discover? I discovered that no social scientist that I know who uses mathematics would have been so careless, so blunt in doing whatever crossed his mind than Gödel. Now, it's possible with retrospect to say that the reason that demonstration is so bizarre is related to Gödel's mental condition. There's a very interesting book by Kasum Noguez about the madness of Gödel. Gödel believed in a world, a Platonic world of mathematical entities that would exist on their own, but he believed also in ghosts, he believed in angels, and there were a lot of delusions that he was talking about in his private notes that Kasum Noguez went to explore. And another issue that could be debated is, why is it that there are so many people and so many great mathematicians who have some serious problems with their mental health? Cantor, Grothendieck, and Gödel. Why is it not redhibitory? Why can you be what is regarded as a psychotic person and at the same time be a great mathematician? The reason I believe is that there's no limit, there's no upper limit, there's no ceiling to the complication of what you can do in a mathematical demonstration. And so to some mathematician, the more complicated it is, the more complex, the more it is probably remarkable for having been done the way it was done. In my case, I was pretty familiar, a bit of an expert, by the way, in what Aristotle had said about the quality of argument in what is called his Organon. And in his Organon, I remind you that he divides the validity of a proof in three great families to start with. What he calls analytics, which is the most rigorous type of reasoning, which mathematicians should resort to. Then there's dialectics. Dialectics is the art of dialogue, and there you can take some liberty with the quality of the argument. Dialectics is especially the what is being done in court in order to convince the a jury. It is done in politics also, well, to convince electors or fellow politicians. And then there's the rhetorics. And rhetorics is convincing by whatever means is possible. And I would say, a common conversation, an example from rhetorics is trying to convince someone with an example of with a sample of one. Yes, you say that, but the neighbor of my niece is a man who said the other day that, etc. Well, that could possibly convince you. The sample is not representative. It is whatever can convince somebody of something. And being very familiar with what Aristotle has written, well, actually, it's lecture notes, what we have there, probably collated by students. But anyway, we know quite a bit of what Aristotle said about the beginnings of logic, which he didn't use talk at all about talking a calling it logic, but making the distinction between analytics, dialectics, and rhetoric. Reading the demonstration by Gödel, I realized that you found in his demonstration, depending where you are in it, some good arguments which can be used in analytics, some not so good one that can be used in dialectics, but there's even stuff like what you can only use in a conversation here or there in the in a bar from rhetorics in the demonstration by Gödel, and people have never heard about his demonstration. there's a sentence like everything is not a proof of A. Gödel resorts also to the reduction ad absurdum, what was called in Latin, proof per impossibile. Aristotle regarded this being usable in dialectics, but not in analytics. It's not rigorous. Why, as you may know, because in a proof per impossibile, you use a syllogism, an existing one, and instead of taking two premises and then deducing a conclusion, you take an existing syllogism, you try to replace one of the premises by something else and see whether it leads or not to a contradiction. And when I explain it that way, you understand that it's not a direct way of going at proving something. But believe it or not, something's very important. Some important principles in relativity theory use nothing more than that type of proof. And believe it or not, but the Big Bang has never been proven by anything but a proof per impossibile, reductio ad absurdum. That would not be too bad, as I said, that Gödel resorts to proof per of a dialectal type, but it's really damaging when he resorts to arguments whose validity is only due to rhetoric, trying to persuade you by whatever means are available. Because in a demonstration, which is a chain of arguments, it's of course the weakest of the arguments which decide about the strength of the whole proof. It's like anything else. It's like any kind of chain. It is the weakest link that would decide about the strength of the chain by letting go. And that applies the same to a demonstration. But Gödel is not the only one not to be aware of that these distinctions that Aristotle made about the quality of the validity of a proof, of the validity of an argument. Most mathematicians, I understand, pay no attention whatever to that, and in particular to that principle that the weakest link will decide about the strength of the whole. If you demonstrate it's supposed to be good enough, there's no regard anymore to the notion of a the validity of the arguments taken one by one. Much is on from the fact that there's a self-reference in the demonstration, that there's a proposition which says about itself that it's provable or non-provable, and many people have drawn parallels between that part of the demonstration and the paradox of Richard, or the paradox you find in Bertrand Russell. The main difficulty, in my view, is not about self-reference. The main difficulty is that nobody has any idea what it is about. What is a proposition that talks about itself? First of all, because propositions don't talk, and they can't say anything about themselves. Why? Because when you say that you're provable or not, as a human being, you are liable to explain what you mean. You're supposed to defend your view. You're supposed to be engaged. You're supposed to take the person that you are at stake for asserting the validity of something. And a proposition, a mathematical proposition, has no capacity at justifying why it says that it is this or that. And this argument that I'm making here, I found it first in Guilbeau's critique of Gödel. And in the book he published with Daval, he makes that same argument. Proposition, mathematical propositions, meta-mathematical propositions in logic or whatever. We're talking about the foundations of mathematics. They have no capacity for expressing views or defending these views once they've been expressed. There's just a... there is an injection there of the world as it is, with people able to defend views within a mathematical demonstration. It's got nothing to do there, whatever. About that proposition that talks about itself, entering into details which must be familiar to you if you're listening to my talk, I will not do so. But as you know, there is a problem there of encryption. It is because a message has been encrypted that it can be under mathematical form, that it can be taken at the same time as being a mathematical formula on which mathematical operation can be operated. And hidden within that, there's a message which has been encrypted, which is about the solvability or not of the proposition itself. There again, Gödel pretends that this has come by accident. He says something of the kind, and as we realize, quite accidentally, it happens that this or that not. He must have spent at least a number of hours to make that encryption possible and to make it as so skillful that indeed there are mathematical propositions encrypted into a mathematical formula. So calling it something that can be happened by accident is just nonsense. It is his skill as a mathematician that has produced a particular result. It's not something that was there somewhere hanging like a low-hanging fruit that you just had to pick in order to put in his demonstration. So the weakness of his demonstration, because it uses arguments of different types. Why did he make it so complicated? In my view, because of, to just show disrespect towards his fellow mathematicians, say a few of you will follow me in that demonstration. And it takes from time to time a social scientist to say, well, okay, interesting challenge. Let's follow that step by step. And when I was a kid, I was very much impressed by a story which was called Spirou and the Robot or something like that. And the plot, it's something for kids. The plot was the following. There was a mad scientist who said he would set the atmosphere in on fire, right? And he produced a kind of balloon where his bomb was hanging underneath. And so Spirou and his companion called Fantasio are trying to prevent that mad scientist, of course, to detonate his bomb. But it happens that the balloon is punctured and the bomb falls into on a field, and our heroes go and have a look with a lot of precaution, and they get there and the bomb is broken, and you can see the insides, and the insides are all broken toys, empty sardine cans, just junk. And that terrified the world, and actually the mad scientist was really mad, and there was nothing really inside there that was a threat of any notion. When I came to the end of the demonstration by Gödel-Wisth theorem, I thought of that bomb which was made out of junk. It is junk. And but there's a lot of it, and it's difficult to follow, and that explains why when his theorem was published, a large number of people said he's a genius, or this is totally stupid, like Bertrand Russell saying, if there's a contradiction in your demonstration where you just stop and you try to fix it. But the complication of it made it very difficult for a number of people to follow it. People would just throw the towel after having read the first quarter or the first third and not go to the very end. When you get to the end, you realize about the poor quality of what it is. Of course, I'm not a mathematician. I don't say he hasn't proved it, but he proved it in such a contrived manner, and showing such disdain to the quality of the arguments he was using. At the end, we're left with this idea: what is it, a true proposition that cannot be demonstrated? What does that possibly mean? Going back to Aristotle, what did Aristotle say about the truth? He said you can arrive at the truth, you can attain it in three different manners. One is through the evidence of the senses. A number of people see something and decide this is the way it is, and there's some kind of agreement, hopefully between experts of the question. And what is it important to do is to be sure there's no illusion, that we're not victims of an illusion somewhere, that our senses don't deceive us. But once there's an agreement about the world as it is, that's a source of truth. The second source of truth, said Aristotle, is definitions. If I say the fawn is the young of the deer, well, I've defined a new term. I could say it's the young of the deer and keep on saying the young of the deer, but I've invented a new term, fawn, and from now on I can say fawn instead of saying young of the deer. In mathematics, a definition, equivalent of a definition is called an axiom. So in mathematics, you have axioms, which are truths by definition. And then you've got a third source of truth, says Aristotle, something that has been demonstrated, demonstrated through a syllogism in logic. In mathematics, you can chain, concatenate syllogism and get to the demonstration of a theorem. When Gödel says there are true propositions that cannot be demonstrated, there's only two possibilities left. Either it's an axiom, and then something went really wrong, because what you've demonstrated is actually just being rephrasing something which was one of your axioms, or the way you went there. So that's a big no-no. It's a big blunder. What you retrieve is an axiom that you had lost somewhere, and you forgot about the fact that it was an axiom that you had started from. And the third possibility is that it's evidence from the senses. So my neurophilosopher, when you're somebody who takes seriously what Aristotle has said about logic, because as Hegel already noticed in his days, not very much has been added to what Aristotle said. A lot has been added since then, but essentially true formalization, true translating into mathematical terms, things which were already known beforehand, like Boole when he formalizes first order logic. So we have no other choice but saying that when Gödel says there are some truths which have not been demonstrated, and we understand that they're not axioms either or definitions, they must derive from somewhere, from the evidence of the senses. There is a stowaway there. There's something that's been important accidentally within the demonstration, and which explains why there's some truth which is not being demonstrated, nor is a definition or an axiom. How is that possible? Well, through neglect. Then there's one way these stowaways can get on the ship. We got the explanation in Turing in his thesis, where there's a large passage about insight, the intuition of the mathematician. It's important that the mathematician has got a good intuition, etc. And then he has, I will never say more about that here in my thesis. The insight, the intuition of the mathematician, of which he's very proud, he or she, but we can't know much more of what it is, except that we can guess where our intuitions come from. Our intuitions come from understanding how the world operates, right? And the world operates in a very physical manner. It is one way or another. The child learns very quickly that if I drop my cup there, it won't go shoot to the ceiling, it will drop to the floor, okay? These are the insights of every one of us, mathematicians included. And when they say, well, you know, I'm not going to discuss exactly how I came to this, there lies the stowaway of the views about the physical world. That means that quite often mathematicians just reinvent the physical world as it is by importing unwillingly they import things which were in their minds, which were just intuitions about the world, how the world operates. So here is the way that true things that were not demonstrated and that were not definitions, that's how they get into the demonstration of mathematical theorems. And that applies in particular to Gödel in his demonstration. By the way, he admitted that he was he had Platonic views, meaning that in his view there's no difference, essentially no essential difference between the world of mathematics and the world of the physical world around us. Why is that called Platonic? You may know, because Plato was the pupil of Pythagoras. Pythagoras, who believed that the nature of everything was made of numbers, of entities of a mathematical nature. Aristotle, the pupil of Plato, was very critical about that. And as you know, he introduced that view that that mathematics were a tool. It was a tool to represent in a stylized way the world as it is, but mathematical notions don't partake, they're not part of the world as it is. They are intellectual tools that we use to describe the world. So my conclusion, how is it possible that Gödel could display that ledger domain, that contempt for his fellow mathematicians, because of his Platonic views? He thinks that he's not inventing something with his theorem. He's convinced that he's describing the world as it is. He believes that he's doing physics and not mathematics. He doesn't say so, but that's implicit. And because he's exploring a world and not demonstrating something which has no value if it's not properly demonstrated, you can use, if you're an explorer, you can use whatever method you want. It's not important. You're discovering things that are there, that are, lie there as they are, and whatever method you can use. I mean, you can go in your boots, you can use be dropped by a parachute if you want to look at, find some particular plant. You can walk 3 days in the forest, or being dropped there by a helicopter somewhere. Doesn't make any difference. And that was this underlying the view that behind, lurking behind the demonstration of Gödel. First, he was arrogant. He thought that he was such a genius, he didn't have to show respect to his fellow mathematicians, but also that he was an explorer and not an inventor, and that therefore whatever method he found, he could prove, he could show that there are true propositions in arithmetic which cannot be proven a part of a demonstration, whatever means were good. We can be critical to that. That's what I try to do. And I've been critical in a number of disciplines, too many according to some people. I think it's important to disentangle, to demystify, show, because I've got that training as a psychoanalyst, to show what are people's motivations and how they operate and why they say what they say. And even if Gödel has been dead now for many, many years, it's important that we analyze his contributions, and that we don't admire them just through delusion, but for good reasons, if that's the case. Okay, thank you so much. Goodbye.